She stood before the rising sun, her breathing perfectly even, her stance completely grounded, not a muscle twitching. She focused on the sun, climbing slowly above the eastern horizon. In the sun, Senhui found balance. In the sun, she found inner warmth. As slowly as the great ball rose, she lifted her arms before her. As so many minutes passed and her arms lifted before her face, she brought her hands together, linked six fingers, and pressed both thumbs together and index fingers together in salute. The sun continued its climb, and her arms moved as if lifting it. She meant to stand there until noon, until her arms above her head were in complete concert with the heavenly cycle. But she didn't make it. As her hands began to lift above her forehead, Senhui felt a stretch in her belly, constricting at first, and then suddenly so painful it had her doubling over and clutching her midsection. The line of the Kichi Kree could not hold the straightened posture. Her life energy had been wounded, and badly. And not just her own, she feared.
The snake venom!
When she had healed the poor girl, her own inner heated hands had taken the venom of the adder into herself. But how had that so wounded her? A Jestetu mystic could do this with little danger, for the Jestetu mystic could overcome poison with ease. And then Senhui understood. A Jestetu mystic was possessed of the inner discipline to defeat poisons, but the unborn child of a Jestetu mystic. He knew as soon as Father Jarek entered the room with Brother Bathyllus and a group of soldiers that things had not gone well between the two of them, for the old man's face was locked in such a scowl as Brother Denard had never seen before.
You have come to question, Blessed Abel.
No, Father, of course not.
And yet there is this.
Father Jarek extended his open hand toward the Book of Jest that Brother Bathyllus still held close to his chest.
Father, as I tried to explain to Brother Bathyllus, this book, these truths of Jest, are no threat to our order or the teachings of Blessed Abel. If we are to believe in divine inspiration, then are we to claim sole province over it?
Oh, and thus you believe that this ancient order received this divine inspiration many years before Blessed Abel?
It is not. There is no threat here.
Where is the woman?
Denard did look at him, and old Jarek's scowl seemed even more pronounced.
Where is she?
She left. She could not tolerate the prejudice and the unwillingness.
The unwillingness to convert to her heathen ways? Did you expect to come here with some false prophet from the land of beasts and undo the blessing of Abel's teachings? Do you believe that your revelations of a few tricks from these Jestetu creatures would turn us aside from our path to spiritual redemption? Brother Denard, did you truly believe that one misguided brother...
No. No, Father, it was never my intent.
Your intent? Whatever did you come to the conclusion that your intent meant anything, Brother Denard? You were given a specific mission, entrusted with a duty to spread the word of Abel to people deserving though ignorant. You were sponsored by and of the Church of Blessed Abel. You were sent by our arrangements and with our money. You seem to have forgotten all these things, Brother Denard.
You misunderstand. The Jester too.
Are the heathens in need of enlightenment? Do you not agree, Brother Denard?
Oh.
Where is your concubine?
She is my wife.
Where is your concubine?
She left. This place, this chapel, this town, this land of haunts itself. She could not tolerate.
She would go south and east and back toward Ethelbert Holding.
Father Jarek turned toward a pair of soldiers as he spoke. Both men nodded.
She'll not get far.
What reason? She has done nothing.
Be easy, Brother Denard. Your concubine is in no danger, as long as she has truly departed this holding. Laird Pride has promised me this.
What are you saying?
Brother Brand Denard, it becomes apparent to me that you have lost your way.
Father Jarek stepped back to give the soldiers access to him.
Perhaps you are in need of some time alone to consider your true path.
She is my wife.
Brother Denard started to take a bold step forward, but before he could shift his weight, the pommel of a sword slammed him hard on the back of his neck. He knew not how much time had passed when he at last awoke, cramped in the dark. The dirt was muddy beneath him, the ceiling too low for him to even straighten up as he sat there. He felt some many-legged creature scramble across his foot. But all he could think of was Senhui. What had he done to her by bringing her to this place? What had he done to their child? Father Jarek sat quietly in his private chamber staring at the troublesome book. It pained him to see his former student so seduced. Jarek had been pleased to learn that Bran Denard, ever a favorite of his, had come home alive and well.
No, not well.
He looked again at the book on the small table. To Jarek's thinking, it would take a monumental effort to ever get the wayward brother well again. Brother Bathalace entered his room.
Ah, he is contrite.
He has not spoken since we put him in the dungeon. He hardly registers our presence when we go to him with food and drink. The only reaction I have seen from him at all was surprise, and perhaps satisfaction, when I asked him yet again the cause of the missing bear woman.
He was pleased that she had eluded us these 3 days, and likely now we will never find her.
Perhaps that is for the best. I fear that if we await contrition before releasing Brother Denard from his cell, that he will die in there. Though perhaps that too would be the best course for all.
Father Jarek answered that with a scowl.
Better even for Brother Denard. His path is a road to eternal damnation. Perhaps he has not yet transgressed too far for divine salvation.
Unrepentant sinners are not welcomed by Blessed Abel, who sits at the feet of God. Keep him incarcerated another week. By then we should know the more about the missing woman.
And if she has not been found?
Well, I have no desire to see Brother Denard dead in our filthy dungeon. If the woman is not found, and our wayward brother has not repented, we will accommodate him more comfortably in a room within the chapel proper.
A cleaner cell?
But a cell, nonetheless. I am willing to spend as much time and energy as we can afford to bring Brother Bran Denard back into the ways of the Order. But he will not proselytize this bastardized version of the message of Blessed Abel. That is not a point of debate.
Laird Pride will agree to this?
Laird Pride will see no threat in Brother Denard as long as we keep our reins on him tight. And I assure you, Brother Bathalace, that Brother Denard will know no freedom until he sincerely repents.
A week later, Senhui had not been found, to the increasing frustration and anger of Prince Pryday. But, true to his word, Father Jarek had ordered a haggard and ill Brother Denard brought from the dungeon and placed in a secure room in the chapel. Denard had lost a great deal of weight, and his body was covered in sores from the standing water and mud. That night, Father Jarek went to him, the Book of Jest in hand and Brother Bathalace in tow. He dropped the book on a table near the bed where the ragged-looking Brother Denard was half-sitting.
Have you something to say to me?
You wish me to translate the tome for you?
Father Jarek's expression grew very tight, and he scowled at Brother Bathalace.
He is to have no visitors. His chamber pot will be replaced every morning, and he will be served meals in accordance with the other brothers. But you will not leave this room. Understand that edict, foolish brother. If a brother you remain, upon pain of death, you are not to leave this room.
You did not even ask him about the woman.
You heard his response.
A misconception regarding your request? He may have thought that his release had been incumbent upon our lessening our opposition to this supposed knowledge he has brought back.
The mere fact that he still harbors any uncertainty concerning that tome, or that he still holds, as his tone evinced, any desire to share the words confined within its pages, is all the proof I need that our wayward brother has not come to the truth. Let him fester through this season and the next. When winter's first winds blow against the walls of Chapel Pride, we will return to him.
She was having a good day, relatively speaking. Senhui had found some measure of energy and strength that morning, and after nearly 3 weeks of seclusion inside Garabon's house, she had dared to go out into the sunshine. She stayed close to the cottage by the lake, though, well aware that the authorities of Pride Holding were seeking her. She managed her Jestichu training ritual that day as well, and though a light-headed weakness did return, Senhui pressed through the ritual to completion. She was still outside, sitting in the shadow under the eaves of the house, when she saw Garibald approaching, returning from one of his rare visits to the town. She saw, from his expression, that things in town were not well.
Where is Dinard?
You should not be outside. They are still looking for you.
Where is Dinard? Tell me.
He is alive, but under guard in the chapel, so I heard. You and Brother Dinard are the talk of all the town, of course.
They are not mistreating him.
Who can know what the brothers do? I doubt you'll be well treated if Prince Pride and his soldiers find you. And that is our main concern.
No.
Yes. There is nothing we can do for Dinard. And do not forget that it was his choice to return to Chapel Pride. I promised him that I would look after you, and I'm not about to go back on my word.
Senhui's expression clearly revealed that she wasn't buying the argument.
This is likely part of the process. Dinard knew that it would be no easy task to persuade the monks.
Where is the book?
Don't know.
You must return to town, to the chapel itself. I will know more of Bran and the Book of Jest. You must do this for me at once.
And mark my house for suspicion? Shall I pause and visit Castle Pride before my return and simply tell Prince Pride that the woman he and his soldiers seek is safely hidden in the tunnels? Or will you remain outside to greet them?
Yes.
I cannot do it, girl.
Senhui didn't argue any further, for her thoughts were already moving in another direction.
Come along inside, then. I've brought some fine spices. I'll make us a stew.
Long after supper, with darkness spreading across the land, Senhui sat across from Garibald as he half sat and half reclined before a roaring fire. She said nothing and brushed off his feeble attempts to begin a conversation. She watched and she waited, and when at last he nodded his head in slumber, she went to her travel sack and rummaged through it, producing the suit of black silk. She changed and went out into the night, trotting swiftly toward the town and Chapel Pride. She spent a moment trying to recall its layout, then moved to the base of the northern wall. There was only one window here, set high up. Senhui fell into herself, grasping the energy of her chi and twisting it so that it battled against the natural pull of the ground. Then she picked out handholds on the wall and began to climb, moving steadily and easily, almost as if she were weightless. She arrived at the window in short order and squeezed through, entering the bedroom of Father Jarek himself. Senhui resisted the urge to awaken him with a chokehold that she might force the information from him. She slipped across the room and through the door to the antechamber. The Book of Jest lay there right before her, opened upon a wooden pedestal beside the low-burning hearth fire. Many other books were set haphazardly on shelves flanking that hearth, and even from this distance, Senhui could see the dust that had gathered on them. Was that the fate that awaited this product of Bran's long toil? She moved away, but before she even reached the door, a renewed wave of nausea washed over her and nearly buckled her legs beneath her. Senhui clutched at her belly, and it took all of her considerable willpower to bring her breathing quickly back under control.
Bran.
She knew that she was in trouble. Her physical exertion in running all the way out here, and even more so, her mystical exertion in scaling and levitating up the wall, had been too much. She only now realized. Senhui glanced back at the Book of Jest. Then she looked past it, to the shelves and the piled disheveled tomes. Glancing all around, improvising as she went, Senhui searched the deepest recesses of the shelves and found a book of roughly similar size to the one sitting on the pedestal. Senhui placed the Book of Jest off to the side, then gently lowered the pedestal to the floor, lining it up with the hearth. She then opened the other book, taken from the shelf, and placed it on the embers, and after blowing on those orange coals for a bit, managed to set the book aflame. With no other options before her, she gathered up the Book of Jest, and with a rueful glance at the room's other door, she staggered back the other way, back into sleeping Father Jarek's bedchamber. She squeezed out onto the windowsill and glanced down the 20 feet or more to the ground. Senhui told herself how important this was, reminded herself of the grim consequences of failure, for her, for Bran, and for the precious book. She felt inside herself again, found the line of chi, and tried again to free herself from the bonds of gravity. She knew she could wait no longer. She turned and slipped down from the windowsill, and then she was falling. She arrived at Garaban's house many hours later, after the dawn, dragging one broken leg, barely conscious, and trembling violently in the grip of a high fever. She was still clutching the book. Senui heard the birds singing every day, but never did she open her eyes at their inviting call. She felt the movement around her and knew it to be Garaban, but he was too distant, and nothing could bring her forth from the damaged shell of her physical body. She tasted the cool water and warm broth when he managed to get some into her mouth, but they were sensations of another time and place, of another world altogether, it seemed. For most of Senui's thoughts remained inward, sharing herself with her unborn child, offering her love and her warmth, watching the awakening of consciousness. It seemed to her such a beautiful and comforting thing that a piece of Bran and a piece of herself should create an entirely different and independent little being. She felt its presence keenly within her own corporeal coil, and knew, after a time, that it sensed her as well. One morning, Senui blinked open her eyes. Curtains covered the room's small window, but the brightness stung her nonetheless. She lay there as time passed, she knew not how long, hours perhaps, before the door was finally pushed open, and Garaban, looking weary and downtrodden, walked in. He moved by the bed, a small cup in hand, and it wasn't until he was even with Senui's head that he noticed her looking back at him.
Are you there?
Garaban.
By God, I thought you'd never awaken. All these days and weeks.
How long?
You've been away from me for almost 5 weeks.
Bran.
Oh, I saw him just 2 days ago. Every passing week, the brothers at the chapel afford him more liberties, though he is not yet able to move about unrestricted, and certainly not out of the chapel. He longs for you. I heard that in his every word. But he cannot come to you for fear that you would be discovered. Leb Pride and that son of his are a stubborn lot.
Someday.
Garaban nodded and started propping up her pillows.
Let us sit you up a bit. You have to get some food in you, for the sake of the child in your swollen belly.
Senui felt his hand touch her there. When she looked down to regard that gentle hand, she saw that she was beginning to show her condition.
A woman with child has to eat. You're feeding, too.
Senui nodded and didn't resist as Garaban helped her to sit up, and then he put the cup to her lips and let her sip its broth contents.
We will get you a solid and hearty meal as soon as you're able. I promised Anard that I would take care of you, and I'm not about to let your stubbornness get in the way of that.
Brother Denard's eyes and thoughts were fixed on the wider world beyond Chapel Pride's open gate as he swept the falling leaves from the courtyard's paths. It was late morning, and already he had been out longer this blustery autumn day than he had in many weeks. Senui was somewhere out there, pregnant and ill. Every fiber in Brother Denard urged him to run off to her bedside, to hold her and kiss her, to tell her that he loved her and to help her back to him. Nothing else in the world, not even his beloved church, seemed to matter beside that image of stricken Senui. For though Garaban had assured him in their brief meeting that she was strong and would pull through, Denard had heard the undercurrent of fear in his seemingly confident tone. He was gaining some measure of freedom here, at least. He had only recently learned of the accident in Father Jarek's chamber and the destruction of the Book of Jest, and while his spirit sank at the great loss to his brethren, and while his heart ached at the thought of his most precious work undone, all that paled in comparison to his fears for Senui and his unborn child. He prayed that Senui would fight through this illness that had befallen her, and that one day he would be able to see their child and hold their child.
Brother Denard, come inside, now.
Denard turned to see Brother Bathalace bidding him to come in. He moved into the shadows within the chapel door tentatively. Bathalace was waiting for him just inside.
Yes, brother?
We have received word concerning you from Chapel Abel.
What?
Of course, we dispatched a courier to Chapel Abel with word of your return and your surprising cargo, book and human. Your fall from the teaching of Blessed Abel is no small thing, not as inconsequential as your death might have proven.
Denard accepted those stinging words without argument.
The brothers at the Mother Chapel will speak with you. As soon as winter lessens its grip upon the land, you will travel north to deliver a full accounting of your journeys in the Land of Bear. A pity that the book does not survive, for I am certain that it would have proven of great interest to our brethren.
When?
At the first onset of spring, as soon as the roads are clear.
How long? I mean, where will I... will I return to Chapel Pride?
Is there something wrong, Brother Donat?
No. No. No, Brother Bathalace, of course not. It is just that I am weary of the road.
The knowledge you have brought back with you from Bear is important to us, of course. If we are to send any more brothers into that vast southern land, as we surely will, then the information you provide may help keep them safe.
There are fewer threats to us in the southern lands than you believe.
I offer this to you as your friend. When you are before the brothers of Chapel of Bell, you would do well to adjust your thinking more clearly in compliance with the edicts of the church concerning the people of Bear. You would do well to remember, Brother Donat, that you went there to teach them, not to be taught by them.
It wasn't until nearly a week after awakening that Senhui realized just how badly her leg had been injured. The limb would not hold her weight. Even using her Gesta II powers of healing and concentration, Senhui knew that it would be a long time before she walked again, if ever. That wasn't her primary concern, however. Her body was in such a weakened state that she could hardly find her line of chi, and even less so that of the child within her. She spent many hours sitting by the window, admiring the beauty of the vibrant coloring appearing on the leaves of the deciduous trees. Senhui had never seen anything like the autumn foliage, or the dance of the leaves as they tumbled from the trees, catching the wind and spinning through every unpredictable fall. Bran Donat had told her of the seasons in his homeland, something unknown in Southern Bear, and Garabond had expanded upon that information now that he had the visual elements showing clearly before them. The leaves would fall, and the trees and the land would go dormant through the winter season, with its blowing snow and bitter cold. And then, in the spring, the buds would bloom anew, renewing the cycle of life. Senhui found that notion comforting through the long days, and she used it to bolster her resolve at those dark times when she felt as if she must fail. All would be better in the spring.
They believe the book destroyed, even Donat.
Senhui looked at Garabond, tilting her head, not sure of how she should take that.
He is devastated by the thought that his work of all those years is no more.
But you did not tell him.
I would do anything to lessen his pain at this time, and most of that pain comes from his separation from you and not from the loss of the book. But no, I did not tell him. I feared that someone might be listening.
You feared that he would be foolish enough to again try to foist that book upon them.
Garabond didn't answer.
He is a stubborn one.
Senhui slipped her hand under the bed and with great effort brought forth the Book of Gest.
Do you read?
I am one of the few outside the Church of the Abel who does, yes.
Come then. I will teach you the language of Gest. You will see what your friend has spent the last years of his life creating.
Garabond hesitated.
Come. We've not much time. The sun is already nearing its apex.
Garabond stepped back out of the room, but only to retrieve a second chair. Searing lines of fire ran through her ravaged body, but Senhui did not cry out. They were down in a smoky tunnel where Garabond thought that they would be safer during this trying and noisy process.
These storms are usually for the middle of spring.
Garabond saw clearly that Senhui wasn't paying him any heed, that she was locked in a life and death struggle against the waves of agony. Never had he felt so helpless. He hadn't ever watched a woman give birth before, and now here he was serving his midwife as the only support, and her pregnancy had not been going well for many months.
What can I do for you?
Senhui didn't answer, other than to take his offered hand and squeeze hard. Inside her, Senhui felt as if someone were grabbing her line of Kichi Kree, pulling and jerking it back and forth. She tried to find some sense of center, some focus of energy, but there simply was none. Spasms shot through her as if they were drops of acid being splashed within her. She reached with all her powers to try to touch her child, to try to find its life energy. And there was something strong in her womb, a powerful force. But it was not a line, she understood. It felt as if the thread of this one's chi had been frayed. More pain built within, faster than she could let it flow from her, and deeper within, the pressure built against the inside of her birth passage. She felt her skin ripping, felt a sudden surge of agony and a contraction of her muscles so powerful that she was certain they must be tearing themselves apart. Senui gathered all her strength, all her energy, and all her disciplined focus. She lifted the thread of her chi, balling it into a formidable force just above her struggling child. Then, as surely as if she were pushing with her hands or legs, she forced that energy down, down. Her skin ripped a bit more, and then she felt a rush of sudden coolness, a great release of pressure, and all her lower body went comfortably numb. She lay there for some time in the cool darkness of semi-consciousness, her body falling into a deep state of relaxation, muscles sinking into the bed as if she were being swallowed by it. Moments slipped past in blissful emptiness, with not a spot of light marring the blackness or a whisper of sound defeating the silence. Not a whisper of sound. Not the beating of her heart. Not the cry of a newborn baby. She was dying. She knew that. And she didn't fight it. Not then. Perhaps it was time for her to surrender. Her child was not alive. Senui realized that her child was not crying, was making no sounds at all. She concentrated her life energy and grabbed at her heart, forcing it to beat. She sent her thoughts back through that blackness, as if she were climbing out of a deep hole, and she finally saw a glow of light. She raced for it, desperately now, as she realized that her child was not yet alive. Her eyes opened, and the room came into focus. She saw Garabond standing off to the side, the child on a table in front of him, blue and still.
No.
Senui rolled off the bed and to her feet. She felt the warmth of her own blood running down her legs and knew that she was bleeding too heavily, but she forced herself into a stumbling walk to the table where she placed both hands on her child. It was a boy, a beautiful boy, a perfect boy. His life force was so weak, barely a sliver of energy in his little body, nor was that thread of energy straight. The typical and expected line of Kichi Kree from forehead to groin. No. She sensed that her child's lifeline was interrupted at many points, was wavering where it should have been straight and solid. He was not perfect, Senui realized with horror. He was damaged, badly so.
Please, you must lie down, Senui, please.
Senui didn't hear him. All that mattered to her was that her baby wasn't breathing, that her baby was damaged, perhaps fatally. She found the connection to his life energy and threw her own into him, offering herself fully to him. She let her chi energy flow out of her and into the child. The blood splashed down her legs.
Lie down, woman! Your blood's running! Too late for the little one!
Senui felt him let go, and then he came back with a thick cloth and placed it hard against her, trying to stem the blood flow. It didn't matter, she knew by then, and she accepted the sacrifice as she came to feel the life force of her child strengthening. The baby opened his eyes and gasped his first breath. To Senui, that sounded like the sweetest music ever sung. She felt her own life energy spasm, a wild dispersal of strength and reflex that jolted her away from her child. She staggered back a step and would have fallen, but Garabond was there, gently catching her and laying her back down on the bed.
My baby?
Garabond took up the child and gently placed it on her chest. Senui wanted to tell him that it was all right. She managed to hold the baby in her arms and feel his softness and the warmth of his breath against her neck. And suddenly, he wasn't crying anymore, but had settled in comfortably. The torch-lit room began to darken once more, the black tunnel's sides rising around Senui. Regret filled her for just a moment as she considered all that she would miss. She threw that emotion aside at once and considered that her baby was alive, that she had given him existence and then had breathed life into him. To Senhui, there was no price too great for that. She let the blackness rise because she knew that she could not resist it. She felt the baby's breath and softness to the last. He hated leaving the child alone, but Garabon didn't know what else to do. Dinard had to know of the babe and of the fate of Senhui, whom Garabond had buried on the small island on the lake, the island where a younger Garabond and Bran Dinard had spent many of their finest childhood days. 2 weeks had passed since the child's birth, and Garabond still had not named him. He hurried all the way into town that cold and wet late winter day. He concocted a story of illness, a general soreness in his legs that would get him into Chapel Pride, begging healing from the brothers. So when he got in sight of the town, he slowed and began walking awkwardly, favoring one leg. He found no resistance at the chapel doors. The common area was nearly deserted this day. Garabond limped in and took a seat.
May I be of service to you, my friend?
Garabond knew the younger man as Brother Riandu.
The cool rains got into my bones. I've come to beg a bit of healing, if that is possible. I'll be putting my crops in soon enough. Oh, but I doubt I could bend over to work the ground.
I haven't seen you regularly in church. It is Master Garabond, is it not?
Aye, that is my name, Garabond of Pride. I live a long way out, brother, and with my weakened knees, the journey is painful. Perhaps if you gave some healing to me, I would be a more frequent visitor in the chapel, bringing donations, what little I have, every time. Brother Brandinard, he promised me some healing if I could return to Chapel Pride after the snows. He did. Our God as my witness.
Of course.
Go and get him then. Go and tell Brother Dinard that his old friend Garabond is here. He'll take that cleverness from your face, I do not doubt.
That would be a rather long walk for me, friend Garabond, for your friend Brother Dinard is not here. At the bidding of Father Jerick, he has gone north to Chapel Abel. I doubt that he will return before the next winter.
Garabond fought hard to keep his eyes from widening with shock and fear. What was he to do now?
Shall I ask Father Jerick to come and speak with you? Or tend your sore knees, perhaps?
Have you any healing to offer my old bones?
The gifts of God are not without recompense. You would find Chapel Pride more accommodating to your pains if you more regularly attended the sermons of Father Jerick and Brother Bathalais.
Garabond turned his gaze from the useless Brother Riandu and slowly rose. He continued to limp slightly as he made his way out of the chapel, then hardly at all through the rest of the town. Once past the gates, Garabond picked up his pace steadily until he had broken into a run, propelled by fear more than anything else. Senhui was gone, Dinard was gone, leaving him with a child to raise, at least until the following winter. Brother Bran Dinard huddled under his heavy cloak, bringing his hands to his chest. He had wrapped his fingers in fur, but that was hardly sufficient against the biting cold wind. Head bowed, leading a donkey, the monk plodded along. Only a week out from Pride, with perhaps 100 miles behind him, Dinard had found that winter had not yet let go. All that he had thought about when leaving the chapel was Senhui and Garabond. She would be close to delivering the baby now, he knew, if she had not already. How he wanted to go to her, but he could not. For he had left Chapel Pride escorted by soldiers. Even after that, Dinard had been aware of eyes watching his every move, scouts for the prince and for Father Jerick, no doubt. If he turned in the direction of Garabond's house, he would give it all away. Thus, he had continued along the northern road, hoping only that he would reach Chapel Abel and be done with his business quickly.
Ah, let me have your cloak, then.
Dinard straightened and looked up, left and right. And as one patch of blowing snow thinned before him, he saw a diminutive but undoubtedly solid figure standing in the road.
He give me your cloak now. Come on, then. I'm freezing me arse off out here. He let me use your cloak a bit and I'll let myself wear it in turn, and both of us will get through this wretched storm. Come on, then.
Poor Dinard didn't know what to do. He thought of attacking the dwarf, but his hands were so cold he doubted he could grasp a weapon. He knew that he shouldn't trust Apari, but still, this was not a normal circumstance. Denard reached up and undid the tie about his neck, then pulled the cloak back from one shoulder.
There you go. Giving me a good target.
Denard didn't see the sudden movement, but he saw the spear flying his way. He tried to dodge or duck, but he was too late. The spear drove into his chest. He was only half aware that he was sitting. He was only half aware as the dwarf pulled his cloak from him. He was only half aware when the dwarf wiped his beret across the bloody wound in his chest. Then the Powri kicked him in the face, but he didn't feel it. All he felt was the cold wind, slowly replaced by the colder chill of death. God's Year, 64. Heavy rain poured down, running in sheets across the steep slopes of the rocky coastline. Priday looked down across the jagged, blood-soaked rocks and shook his head, his long brown hair flying. The warriors had dislodged the Powri again, but had gained only a few score yards of ground. The dwarves had merely retreated to the next defensible high ground in this up-and-down terrain of one fortress-like stone ridge after another. And there they were, digging in, no doubt, and preparing the next ridge after that one for the next retreat, forcing the humans to battle for every inch of ground. Banagran walked up beside his prince and dropped a trio of berets at Priday's feet.
You claim them as your own, my liege.
Priday looked at his dear and loyal friend. Banagran was a giant of a man, not so much in height, though he was several inches taller than the norm, but in girth. His shoulders were nearly twice as wide as Priday's, and Priday was no small man. And his bare arms were as thick as a man's thigh, with the corded muscles one would expect on the hammer arm of a blacksmith. His black hair was long and dripping in the rain like Priday's, and though he tried to keep his beard short and his cheeks clean-shaven, as was the style of the day, the long days and difficult conditions were allowing that beard to get away from him. Even with that scraggly look, however, Banagran kept a youthfulness about him, with a broad and often flashing toothy smile and cheeks that dimpled. His face often turned red, either in mirth or battle lust, and that set off his dark eyes and eyebrows, which seemed, really, like a single thick line of hair. Priday glanced down at the berets. So Banagran had killed three more in the latest fight. He was making a reputation for himself that would resound from one end of Hans to the other before this campaign was done. Who could have known the prowess this warrior would come to show, or the strength? In the early days of their adventuring, a few years before in Pride Holding, Priday had always outshone his friend. No more, the prince knew. Priday was more than holding his own, despite the loss of his prized chariot and fine horse team in the first week of fighting. But Banagran had caught the notice of every laird in attendance, and no champion wanted to challenge this one.
Take them. More than a few here complaining openly about the mud and the rain and the shit and the blood. They're needing a hero to keep them steady on the line when those dwarves come back at us. And you know those vicious little beasties will do just that.
Priday looked around. So many wounded and so many dead. The folk of Pride Holding, who had accompanied the prince on this journey to the eastern coast, had been away from home for more than 2 years now. And nearly half, at least, would never return.
Bloody caps coming!
Priday and Banagran looked down the line to see a wave of dwarves swarming over the crest of a stony ridge and charging toward the human line. Archers let fly, but the barrage hardly seemed to slow the fierce dwarf advance.
Right beside you, my liege.
They're going against Ethelbert's line.
The dwarves bunched together at the base of one ravine and began scrambling up. Above them, the men of Ethelbert Holding threw rocks and launched arrows, but the dwarves pressed through the volley.
Take the men down.
My liege?
Bring the men of Pride into the gully. We'll cross below the fighting, and when Ethelbert drives the Powrys back, they will find the metal of Pride Holding blocking their retreat. Yes. They'll have the high ground coming against us, but they'll have no coordination across their line.
Yes, my liege.
Banagran hustled off, calling the men of Pride to order.
Onward!
Prince Priday led the charge straight ahead and down the rocky slope. They swept into the gully, then turned south. Before Pryde's forces could position themselves, the dwarves above to the west, apparently seeing the Vi's closing about them, began to break ranks and came charging back down the slope.
Tight groups! See to your kin!
Half the dwarves tumbled in their flight down the steep ground, but if that bothered the hardy barrel-chested folk, they didn't show it. Like stones rolling, they hit the lines of the men of Pryde. Banagran and Pryde spun, looking to see where they could fit into the continuing brawl. One group of Pryde men nearby was sorely pressed by a trio of dwarves until the prince and his champion leaped into the fray. Pryde paused and glanced up the slope to see the men of Ethelbert holding, cutting the remaining dwarves into smaller and smaller groups. More and more of those Powries broke and ran.
Come along then, lad Ethelbert!
If the army of the southeastern holding didn't immediately pursue, his and his men would be even more sorely pressed. And at first it did seem as if the men of Ethelbert would hold their defensive position on the high ground.
Come along, come along!
Laird Ethelbert himself appeared among the ranks on the ridgeline, scanning the unexpected fighting down below. He locked eyes with Pryde then. Smiling and nodding, he ordered his men down to the aid of their Pryde companions. Powries broke left and right. Some tried to cross the ranks of Pryde's men, all in a desperate effort now to get away. And many did escape, but many did not, their blood running with the rainwater along the stones of the gully. When it was done, Banagran held a handful of brays out to Pryde, but the prince smiled and shook his head.
I have enough of my own this time.
Banagran returned that smile and nodded.
Take the ridge to the east! No retreat to the west! One less gully to cross on our march back to the sea.
Those men who were able trudged up the slick eastern slope and began settling in among the many large rocks. Pryde remained in the gully, moving among the injured, offering comfort and calling for brothers of Abel to come with their healing gemstones. He stayed with one gutted man, a boy, really, of about 15 winters. Pryde took the boy's hand in his own and locked stairs.
Undying, my prince!
Priests!
Won't do any good, Prince Pryde. Are you there? Prince Pryde?
I am here.
Oh, but it's cold. Oh, my prince. Oh, where'd you go then?
Pryde tried to call him back, to offer some words of comfort, but his voice caught behind the lump in his throat.
My prince, it's so dark and cold. I can't even feel my feet. Oh, my arms. It's all...
A monk of Abel arrived then, soul stone in hand.
Too late.
I'm sorry. I was tending another...
Could have done nothing for him anyway. The wound was too great.
I am sorry.
Pryde started to walk away, but hesitated there for some time, looking at the dead boy, remembering his own past adventures a decade before, when he was more slender, when his eyes held a youthful luster, and when he thought he could conquer the whole world. Banagran walked up to him.
We lost seven more, though it could go as high as a dozen. And I'm thinking that we should surrender the eastern ridge and pull back to the west, for we're out in front of the rest of the line.
The southern men did not advance.
Laird Ethelbert retreated as soon as the last of the dwarves went out of the eastern ridge. And probably wise that he did. None of the other lairds saw fit to advance, and we'd all be sticking out like a spur begging to be clipped. Those Powries are not fools, my liege. They could use the same twist on us that we just used against them. Sweep in behind us and cut us from our kin.
Make sure that all the wounded and the dead are brought back behind Laird Ethelbert's lines. Then bring our charges all back to the crest north of Ethelbert. A fine fight, but no ground gained.
No ground lost, either.
Prince Pryde continued to scan the rocky area. Wet, cold, and aching from head to toe, he was weary of this campaign. The combined armies of Hans had chased the Powries to the coast in short order, but it had been day after day and week after week of fighting since.
One ridge at a time.
That was among the most daring maneuvers I have ever witnessed, Prince Pryde.
The two turned as one to see Laird Ethelbert walking his warhorse down toward them.
I grow weary of advancing one ridge and then retreating to the previous.
Three forward and two back. But still, more than a few bloody caps met their end this day, thanks to the daring maneuver of the men from Pryde Holding.
If Laird Grunion and his men had closed from the south, more would lie dead.
Night is falling, and it will be a dark one. After this rout, the dwarves will not return before dawn. Take supper with me in my tent this night, my friend Pryday, and pray bring your champion with you.
Pryday watched the Laird of Ethelbert Dos Entel as he turned and casually paced his mount away. Ironically, it was exactly that steadiness and solidity that for a moment unnerved Pryday. He couldn't dismiss the stark contrast of Ethelbert in his shining and clean armor, so calmly walking his warhorse past the torn bodies of fallen men. Some dead, others grievously wounded, some even reaching up toward him desperately. That's what it was to be a leader among men in Hans. The godly separation between laird and peasant, between noble and common. Ethelbert was above them. Pryday could clearly see. The prince thought of the boy who had just died.
A peasant. A commoner.
Pryday shrugged and put the boy's dying words out of his mind. Neither Pryday nor Banagran spoke as they crossed from the forward lines to the rear. They entered Laird Ethelbert's tent with little fanfare and, to their surprise, found none of the other lairds within. Ethelbert smiled widely and warmly, bidding them to enter and to sit opposite him at the opulent dinner table that had been set out. To either side of the laird sat his four military commanders, accomplished warriors all, men whose reputations had preceded them to this war.
I am so pleased that you could join me, Prince of Pride.
Attendants moved immediately to put their food before them.
A proper laird must always take his accoutrements with him. We owe that to our peasants, you see. What the peasants need from us is the hope that their own lives might not always be so miserable, or that their children will know a better existence. That is always the way, do you not understand? A miserable peasant with hope is a miserable peasant placated. We walk a fine line between breaking them all together, which would lead to open revolt, and teasing them just enough to keep them happily working.
Happily?
Laird Ethelbert seemed to take no offense. He grinned and held up his hands.
There is so much to learn about ruling the common folk. I have spent 40 years as leader of Ethelbert Holding, and still I feel as if my initiation has only just begun. But the people of Ethelbert are happy enough, I would guess, and healthier than those in many other holdings. Delaval in particular.
Pryday perked up at the disparaging reference to the largest and most populous holding in all Hants. Set at the base of the great river that cut the main region of Hants off from the vast northern forests, Laird Delaval's city was more than twice the size of Ethelbert's. The river teemed with fish, the fields to the east of Delaval's city were rich and fertile, and the wood brought in from the west allowed the Laird Delaval to build wondrous sailing ships that even Laird Ethelbert had been known to grudgingly purchase. Laird Delaval's army and his warships were battling Powrys up the coast in the north, and with great success by all reports. That success of his rival seemed to grate on Laird Ethelbert, from what Pryday could tell. It all began to make sense to the warrior prince from Pride Holding. The roads had brought the holdings of Hants closer together, had greatly increased trade and communication between them. Several lairds were rumored to be in secret alliance already. During this campaign, with so many armies marching side by side, Prince Pryday had come to envision a time, in his lifetime perhaps, when Hants would become a united kingdom under a single ruling laird. Of course, that presented the question of who that leader might be.
We are scoring the greatest victories of all against the Powrys. More of the vicious dwarves have died here than in the north, and I attribute that to the finer coordination between our forces. In the north, of course, there is little cooperation, and a more hierarchical command. Laird Delaval is not interested in the plans and movements of his peers, unless those movements follow his precise instructions. This battle will be done soon.
We can hope for that.
Indeed. And when it is done, we must all be aware that Hans will emerge a different land than the one of scattered holdings which began this campaign. The roads are nearly clear of Powrys and goblins, from the gulf to the mountains, and our people will be able to trade even more vigorously outside their communities. Thus we must anticipate the changes, my friends. We must prepare ourselves for the new reality that will be Hants. Smaller holdings, such as your own, will need allies. Or perhaps even an overseeing laird of a greater holding to secure your defense.
An overseeing laird?
Various cities joined together in a greater and more powerful holding.
Are you asking permission to annex Pride, Laird Ethelbert?
I'm suggesting that you and your father begin to give consideration to your future.
We ever do. That is the duty of an independent laird above all, is it not?
Be reasonable, Prince Pride. When this messy business with the Powrys is done, the world around you will be changed. You cannot deny that. Roads carry trade, and they also carry armies.
And Hans will no longer be a collection of separate holdings?
A few, perhaps. Or perhaps a single kingdom. We all see that. And you must understand that in the end, it will be Ethelbert or it will be Delaval. I offer you a peaceful alliance.
You mean a subjugation?
No, not so. For all purposes, your land will remain your own and under your control. Though, yes, I will speak for you in the greater affairs of Hans. I will require some taxes, to be sure, and your share of the men to serve in the forces who will defeat all challenges. But for the family of Pride, life will hardly change, and certainly not for the worse.
And if we refuse your generous offer?
Who can say what will happen? Will an army from Delaval march upon you?
Will an army from Ethelbert?
Of course not. We are comrades in arms, joined in common struggle. I admire your independence, young Prince of Pride. It is one of the reasons that I come to you so early with my offer, and the reason I do not wait until you have more wine inside of you to openly make this offer. The plague in the sea took my offspring, you have no doubt heard. I am childless. The line of Ethelbert will end with my passing. If I had a son as worthy as Pride, I would die content. But enough of speculation. We have fine food to share and a fresh victory to better consume our conversation. Drink heartily and eat until your belly rumbles with content, I pray you. To Prince Pride the Bold!
Pride noted that two of the four Ethelbert commanders seemed less than thrilled at that, though they did lift their goblets to him. Branson Garabon consciously thrust one hip forward and then the other, rocking his frail body so that his legs alternately dropped in front of him. He was small for his age and desperately thin. His unkempt hair was black as a raven's wing, and his eyes, too, favored his mother's southern heritage, showing so brown as to appear black. His skin was more brown than most in the region, but not enough to show that he had the blood of bear running through him, particularly in a land where the peasants were almost always dirty. Besides, no one ever looked closely enough to notice, for the more obvious distinctions of Branson, like his awkward walk or the purple birthmark that circled his right arm, separated him from the folk of Pride more than the nuances of his heritage ever could. Over the years, the young boy had learned to give a hasty glance at each footfall to determine if the foot was firmly planted so that he could continue. He couldn't feel the ground beneath his feet, and if he stepped on an uneven surface or put his foot down on an edge, he would stumble and fall. Fortunately for the boy, he knew every step of every road in the eastern reaches of Pride Town and all the way out to his father's house by the lake. He rarely fell these days, unless, of course, one of the other boys ran over and knocked him to the ground, just so they all could laugh at him while he flopped around.
I don't like to drool. I can't feel the drool. I don't know when I'm doing it, but they laugh. And even the men and women stare or turn away in disgust. The drool and the snot, always it is on my face and crust in my sleeves. I don't like it. Stork!
That's what they called him. He knew he was doomed. Branson locked his eyes forward and forced his hips to rotate faster, propelling him along at a great pace for him, one jerking stiff-legged stride at a time, his head lolling and his arms flailing all the while. He didn't stop his forward-leaning walk as the boys came up. He had come into town to buy some grain for Garabond, and he was determined to push through this inconvenience. He brought his arm up in a jerky motion and wiped it across his face, and though he unintentionally smacked himself quite hard, he didn't blink or show it at all. After another minute, The two boys ran around him, blocking his way.
Hello, Stork.
Branson kept moving, but Tarkus bashed him in the chest with his open palm.
Leave me alone! I have to buy.
Tarkus slapped him across the face. Branson narrowed his eyes and stared intently at his nemesis. At that moment, standing perfectly still, face locked in a determined and hateful grimace, Branson did manage some measure of intimidation, did seem, for just an instant, as formidable and normal as anyone else. Tarkus even backed off a step, but the other boy came forward and shoved Branson hard. He hadn't even been able to close his mouth as he hit, and now tasted dirt and blood. Branson fought hard against the tears welling up. He didn't want to cry. He tried not to cry in front of anyone anymore, other than Garibald. He could cry in front of his father. His father often cried with him.
Bye.
His father, Garibald, had told him that his life would get better as he got older. But in fact, the last year had been the worst. Most of the menfolk, including the older boys, were away at the Powry War. Those older boys had never been kind to Branson, but their abuse was usually more verbal than physical. Since they had left, though, the boys of around Branson's age had taken free run of the town without restraint. Branson settled back down in the dirt, allowing himself to relax for a moment. As he started to rotate his shoulders so that he could roll to one side, his feeble arm finding a supporting angle in the dirt, Branson felt a hand grab his shoulder.
Are you all right?
Branson allowed his helper, a girl his age, to turn him over, and he looked into a beautiful face.
Kate Dale.
She was not tall for his age and was thin, like all the peasants. But she had a softness to her, a rich and smooth texture to her skin that many of the other poor commoners lacked. Her blue eyes seemed to glow when she smiled. Her whole face seemed to glow, for Kay Dale blushed often and almost always when she smiled. Her hair was long and mostly straight, the color of wheat, and it flowed like tall stalks in a windblown field.
Oh, Branson, every time I see you, you're dirty.
It was not an insult. Branson knew that from the tone of her voice, and simply because it was Kay Dale who had said it. She never insulted him, never hurt him. She never judged him, and even wiped the snot and spittle from his face without complaint. And most important of all to him, she always waited patiently for him to stutter through his broken sentences. With Kay Dale's help, he got back to his feet.
Thank you.
You pay them no heed. They're stupid is all. And they know they're stupid and they know you're not.
Branson smiled, but he didn't believe her. Still, it was comforting to hear the words.
You've blood on your shirt. Were you fighting?
No, Ma.
Did someone hit you? Or did you trip and fall?
Well, it's not me blood, Ma. It's Branson's. The boys were beating him again. He cut his lip.
As if they've nothing better to do than beat the poor creature. The folk are nasty, Kay Dale. Meaner than you'd ever believe. How did you get yourself involved in it?
Well, I yelled at them and they ran off. I just helped Branson up is all.
You listened to me. You did right in helping him. You always help him or anyone else needing your help. I'm proud of you.
Kay Dale didn't understand why it was such a big deal to her ma, for she did not know that her mother had once been treated more horribly than she could ever imagine. She didn't know that her mother had once been thrown into a sack with a poisonous viper, then hung by her wrists in the wilderness and left to die. Only the generosity of strangers had saved her.
Come inside and be quick about it.
Garibald put his hand on the boy's back and ushered him along more quickly, the older man's gaze darting about the tree line surrounding his small fields. Bernivagar was out there, Garibald knew, watching Branson with sudden interest. Garibald wasn't surprised by that, other than the fact that it had taken the old and vicious Samhaste this long to take note of the crippled youngster. The Samhastes were not typically kind to such inferior people, for theirs was a brutal religion, ever searching for sacrifices to give their scowling gods, the dreaded ancient ones that haunted haunts. Like the second-born twin, cripples were considered appropriate gifts. and now Garabond suspected Bernivagar was watching Branson. Garabond watched the boy stagger across the room, pivot on one foot, and fall into a seat. His lip was blue and swollen on one side, and it looked as if he had chipped a tooth. Garabond silently berated himself for allowing Branson to go into town that day. He had been against it, but Branson, with his typical pig-headedness, had argued and argued. The boy was determined to live a normal life, but it would never be, Garabond knew. The folk of pride, the folk of any holding in all hunts, would never allow it. The weary man thought back to the day of Branson's birth, when Senui had given her life to save him. She had thought it a generous deed, no doubt, but Garabond had to wonder. Many times during those early years, when the extent of Branson's infirmities had become clear, Garabond had entertained the thought of putting a pillow over Branson's face and peacefully ushering him into the quiet realm of death. It broke his heart to watch Branson staggering around, to hear the insults hurled his way, to see the other boys mocking him with their stork walks behind him. It broke his heart to see the boy covered in blood day after day, whether from the bullying blows or from his own clumsiness. Would Branson be better off dead? The question remained inescapable for Garabond, but, in truth, it was already answered, and definitively. Senui had answered it with finality when she had thrown her life force into the dying infant, and it was not in Garabond's province to go against that choice she had made. He wanted only to protect the boy.
Kaidael!
My boy, you lie down and rest and think of your little friend.
He watched as Branson settled down on his cot and on his pillow, which was formed of a folded and rolled silk suit of black clothing. In looking at that pillow, Garabond was reminded of how special, how magical Senui had been, and how magnificent were the works of the Gestetu, for the pants and shirt and the soft, flexible shoes hadn't worn out in the least over the last decade, and Branson's spittle and snot seemed to gain no hold on the soft and smooth material. Garabond thought of the Book of Jest and the Sword of Senui, both of which, like Branson, had been entrusted to his care. He would protect them as he protected the boy. He looked at the frail figure lying across from him and wondered how in the world he could do that. He closed his eyes and tried not to think of the terrible fate that awaited Branson if he should die before that boy, or if wretched old Bernivagar got his filthy nails on him. The thought of the Samhaste had Garabond glancing back over his shoulder and out the door, which he quickly closed and barred.
The Saga of the First King is continued on the next disc.